name is Peter Florence, and it's a great honor to be here. I would just like, before introducing my guest, to thank some of the people who make it possible for us all to be here. Our principal sponsors, Fundación MAPFRE, Cerejón, SAN, and most of all today for this event, BBVA. I would also like to pay tribute to my colleagues, particularly Diana Gedeon and Ana Maria Raponte, and most of all Cristina Fuentes, the director of this festival, whose vision and energy has brought us all here. My guest is an astonishingly successful, popular, and admired novelist, short story writer, screenwriter, librettist. We're going to talk for 45 minutes and then take questions from the audience. I would first like to welcome you, Ian. Thank you for being here.
Well, it's a great pleasure and thrill, exciting to be in Cartagena.
May I start by asking a question about tone? Your work is often dealing with extremities of love and death, of sex and violence, but with a restraint and a discretion in the prose, which is not showboating, not in any way self-glorifying, but is like Flaubert, sometimes your own presence is an absence. And I'm fascinated by how you as a writer think about prose itself.
Well, I suppose in some ways I belong in a British intellectual tradition of empiricism, of pragmatism, of taking pleasure in naming the thing itself. And I share with Vargas Llosa an admiration for Conrad in that. Conrad was a great namer and celebrator of the thinginess of the world. And so I do love prose to do magic tricks, but I also sometimes think that it works well for me as a reader, as well as for a writer, when it's like a sheet of glass and you look straight through it, not to the word, but to the thing that the word names. Not for the sentence simply performing, although we want it to perform, but to give you the thing that the sentence refers to. So that's been a premise for me almost from the very beginning when I started writing at the age of 21 or 22. I like writers, and in particular, let's say Updike, or from a completely different tradition, Rudyard Kipling, Conrad I mentioned, Saul Bellow, who have taken it upon them not to necessarily let their characters sprout wings and fly out windows, but to engage with a plausibly reenacted world, the world that we share even as we sit here at this moment. In other words, realism, I guess. That's where I place myself, and the prose follows.
And in the prose, when you're present and have a direct relationship with the reader, as Ian McEwan, it seems to me often that that is a wry complicity about comedy or humor.
Yes, I remember when I was 21 or 22 writing my first stories and handing them around to friends for their comments. And they thought my stories were very darkly comic. I mean, those are the ones who actually liked them. When they were gathered up together and published in a first book called First Love, Last Rites, I was horrified by the response. And actually, the response was perfectly reasonable. These stories produced a catalogue of weirdos, psychopaths, very violent people with strange imaginations, outsiders. And the press response was, they liked the prose, but they were horrified by the content. And it was suddenly like being found out. I thought, well, where's everybody's sense of humor? It's vanished. I, at that point, thought, and this was the early 70s, that really we had lived through a century that had Joyce in it and William Burroughs and Jean Genet, and there was nothing that you could not say. But I was wrong. In English literature in the 70s, it seemed there was a great deal one could not say. But I've kept faith with a certain kind of, a certainty that if you have to name something, you name it. If it falls in your way, on your path, then you must deal with it. And for that reason, I find sometimes a certain kind of detached wryness is very useful.
You followed two collections of short stories with two extraordinarily powerful short novels, The Comfort of Strangers and The Cement Garden. What did you feel at that stage about scale and form for writing?
I was a slow starter. I loved the short story. For me, it was a sort of laboratory. I mimicked other writers. In fact, some of the writers I loved most, I wrote parodies of. The great thing about the short story is you can fail and only lose 2 weeks of your life. You can write a terrible short story. It doesn't work. You can move on. I'm always giving this advice to young writers. Don't start with the 800-page novel. Start with the 15-page short story. Let the short story be your experimental laboratory, your crucible. Try on voices, like trying on clothes or disguises. Keep moving. Don't hang around. Absorb the world into your life until you find the rhythm and voice that suits you. So when I got to finally writing a novel, it owed much of its structure to the short story. The first novel, The Cement Garden, really ran from A to Z in a straight line. There was no subplot. It was highly structured. Its characters were very contained. Children cut off from the rest of the world, their parents dead. Enacting a set of difficult relationships within this isolated house that nobody visits. And in a way, it was a cover for my own nervousness, my own tentative first steps into the novel. And the second novel was rather the same. A young English couple, rather lost in Venice, become fatally entangled with another couple. Once again, the claustrophobia was Venice, the narrow streets, the ease with which one gets lost, the oppressive atmosphere. Again, I was still only taking my first faltering steps, but I thought at that point, enough. I've written myself into a corner. I've got to get out of this claustrophobia. I've got to learn to be a larger writer. So I stopped writing fiction altogether for a few years, and I wrote screenplays. And somehow, writing a screenplay pushes you further out into the world. Dialogue, social situations, taking into account history, making the stage wider for myself was very important. So that when I came back to my novel that took me about 7 years to write, in fact, it was called The Child in Time, in many ways I had align myself more with the traditional novel that took into account places, times, larger stages, and so on. So I was a very, very slow, tentative learner in this field.
You've alternated throughout the last 30 years contemporary novels with explorations of 20th century history, sometimes, as with The Innocent and Black Dogs, with a European ideal, and specifically the examination of Germany and the political ramifications of the aftermath of the Second World War. But how do you find your subject matter, and how do you match it to contemporary or historical modes?
Certainly not by thinking about it. Nabokov, in one of his lectures to students at Cornell University, gave some very good advice to these first-year literature students. He said, don't think about themes when you read a book. You're only now just beginning to learn how to read a book. think about detail in a novel and learn to fondle, to embrace and fondle these details. And although that was advice to readers, I think it's also a very good description of what writers do. We don't generally think, I am now going to write a novel whose theme is the failure of this or that, or the growth of something else, or human destiny. We generally start with something small, some particular, some little suggestion, a sigh, a remark, a scrap of newspaper information, an overheard remark. Sometimes for myself, I doodle myself into a sentence or a paragraph, and it has a kind of weight that won't leave me alone. When I started Atonement, for example, I didn't think, oh, I'm going to write a novel about atonement. That title didn't come to me for much later, nor did I think I'm going to write a novel about redemption or the Second World War or what it means to recuperate a mistake. I simply was dawdling one day while my children were out playing. We were in a holiday camp. It's a horrifying place in Holland. And I was on my own for an hour or two, and I wrote a paragraph about a young girl coming into a room, an 18th century kind of room. She's holding a bunch of wildflowers that she's just picked. There's a young man out in the garden, a gardener, in fact. She wants to talk to him, but she doesn't. She's a bit confused. She's annoyed with him. She wants him. She's very confused indeed. It was 600 words, and I had no idea why they appealed to me so much. I didn't know who she was. I didn't know where this house was. I didn't even know which century this was. And for a while, I toyed with the idea that this actually was a science fiction novel. It was set in the 23rd or 24th century, that the young man outside was... It was a time... Why am I telling you this, giving this away? It was a time when the elites preferred to live like the gentry, the aristocracy of the 18th century. And it was the proletarians, the working class, who had all the technology, including, in this young man's case, a little implant in his head that allowed him direct access to the internet. Now, this was going to be a terrible novel, as you can tell. I abandoned it with all the speed of a man leaving a bad party, making my excuses. And it just sat there. I knew that I had started a novel, but I didn't know which one it was, in a sense. And only slowly did I write what is now the second chapter of Expiacion. I then gave this young woman a sister. And even as this sister, young Bryony, began to fill the page, I realized that she really was the heroine, not her sister. And then, within a few months, I saw the whole thing. But I tricked myself into this. One doesn't begin with themes. You begin with the small things.
I just have to put a spoiler alert into this question. For anyone who hasn't read Atonement, I'm about to screw it up for you. At what point, when you realized you were dealing with what is in one sense a big classic narrative set in a time of war, did you know that what you were doing was turning the convention on its head and creating something slightly different? Was it right when you first found Bryony?
As soon as that young girl had some existence on the page, I understood that she was also the author of the book, and that she was maybe 80 years old, 78 years old, and that she was recalling a time and also fictionalizing it. And I could only do this glancingly. I couldn't do it totally, but I thought how liberating it is to stop being a 50-year-old novelist and become a male novelist and become an 80-year-old female novelist. By stepping into these other shoes, I was somehow freed from myself. And so much else followed from that, that this was a novel about literature, about how literature tells its stories. And when I'd finished, I remember feeling rather apologetic. I phoned my publisher and I said, you're going to have a hard time selling this novel because I think it's only going to appeal to writers, really. It's a rather long, I said, and I was genuinely apologetic about this. It's a rather long meditation on the nature of modernism in fiction and how fiction lines up with the reality it describes. That's why I'm not a publisher. So again, these things grow out of the stuff you've already got. That's all I mean.
Can I ask about another specific? Because for many critics and many readers, and Atonement, your rather difficult novel about modernism, sold 5-6 million copies. For those people who've read Enduring Love and many of your other works, you have an ability to conjure incredibly powerful physical images that, A, are wonderful, in the sense that as readers we take pleasure in discovering them and thinking about them. But I wonder whether you feel, specifically with the incident of the balloon accident at the beginning of Enduring Love, whether it has unbalanced the novel in that it is so powerful.
No, I think one of the ways I think of novels is to think of them like symphonies. You know, they can start with a crash. Let's think of a symphony. Let's not be too general. Mozart's Haffner symphony starts with an exhilarating octave leap. Dum, 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 dum. And then it finds its way into other channels of peace, tranquility, and then it erupts again. And novels can do that too. You don't have to just build to a climax at the end. You can start with a clash of symbols at the beginning. Here was a case of me writing a novel, and after a year, I still didn't have the beginning of the novel. I wrote the inside of the novel first, but I didn't have the opening chapter. Then I was walking in, I was hiking. I like to hike. I was walking with a friend, and he told me that he had read in a newspaper of a balloon accident in Germany. This was just when the internet was beginning to come into life, but not everybody had access to it. Unfortunately, my wife, Annalena, was working at the Financial Times, and she had privileged access. And she was typing Balloon Death Germany, and all we could get was Balloon Death. And she was faxing me. Do you remember the fax machine? Pages and pages of balloon deaths. It was at which point I decided I'm never going up in a balloon. Don't believe anyone who tells you they're safe. I have 70 closely typed pages of balloon deaths all over the world. And it became clear to me I had my opening. I saw it. We never traced this particular balloon death in Germany till much, much later. But the thought that six people are holding down a balloon in a high wind, that a gust of wind will come and lift the balloon a few feet into the air, that if everybody hangs on and cooperates, the balloon will be steadied and return to the ground. But if one person breaks ranks, if one person lets go, then it's quite rational for everyone else to start to let go because they don't want to be left being swept up into the air. And I thought, this has a deep kind of meaning for me. It seems like the beginning of morality here. How cooperation holds as long as everybody else is cooperating. When it starts to break down, as it might do in a war, in a civil war especially, and all that cooperation goes, then all hell breaks loose. And so I had the opening of a novel. I wrote that opening, I think, in 2 days, two insomniac days. And I had the sense of a pulse, a drumbeat. I don't find any problem with a novel that opens fast and then draws breath. to begin to examine what is done. It's the exact opposite, for example, of Atonement, which has a 63,000 words of build-up to a particular event with much psychology in place. This is the exact reverse. An event happens, and the rest of the novel begins to speculate exactly what it means and exactly what happened. People have different memories. Human memory is a very imperfect machine. We do not seem to be evolved to have a clear grip on everything that happened to us. In the way comes memory, falsified by belief or by emotion or by wish fulfillment or plain inaccuracy. We're great self-persuaders. So the novel became an investigation, really, of all those things.
When you talk about memory and recovery and retelling, that I presume your interest in that and your exploration of it led in some way to your interest in neurological science and the way in which our very rational minds can be played around with. And that must have led in some way to Saturday.
Well, one of the great mysteries, I think, of the world is the fact that 1 kilo of this soggy, grey stuff in this knob of bone on our shoulders can produce this bright inward cinema of reality, of a self, of dreams and thoughts and deductions and so on. And I'd always had this secret desire to see a living brain. And once I started writing Saturday, I found a friendly brain surgeon, a neurosurgeon, who took me under his wing. And after talking to him for over a period of 6 months, I started to attend brain operations, neurosurgery. I became a familiar figure in my scrubs. I hung out in the coffee room. I got to know the anesthetist. I was such a familiar item in there that one day I was standing by the patient. The neurosurgeon was conducting his operation, and a couple of students came in the room. Fifth-year medical students, and they came over to me and they said, excuse us, doctor, do you mind if we watch? And would you please explain to us what's going on? And I said, certainly. And I took them over to the light box and I said, we're clipping an aneurysm on the MCA, the middle cerebral artery, and we're taking this route. I thought, I now know this, I can do this. And at the end, they thanked me for letting them stand around and watch, and they went off. And I've often wondered to myself how they did in their exams and whether they knew they were talking to a novelist and not a neurosurgeon. But it was, for me, the most intense involvement with research I've ever had. You ask about rationality. Well, we are rational creatures, but we're many other things beside. And I think some of the most interesting areas of exploration, if we think of novels as investigations of human nature, are precisely in this matter of setting what we know with our rational minds, with what we know in our hearts, or what we want with our emotions, and how these things get tangled. We certainly are not automata who make simply only rational calculations. We're many, many other things as well. And so Saturday was, in some sense, as it turned out, I didn't quite know how it would go, an exploration of that.
What did you start? What did you start it with?
Well, it started with this. Endless notes going nowhere, and then suddenly I wrote a sentence about a man waking in the middle of the night and stepping out of his bed. His wife is asleep by his side, and just standing there. And I thought, oh, here's my character waiting to be dressed, as it were. Just a naked man. There was something that struck me about the purity of this. He doesn't know why he's awake. He doesn't know what wakes him. And he walks over to the window of his bedroom and looks out. A wintry scene in a city. It simply appealed to me. And there's no other, you know, it's a bit like you might be on the beach, as was famously once described by another great scientist. And you bend down and pick up a stone that appeals to you. Not that one, but this one. So there it was, and another detail that I sat with for a long time, thinking, who is this man? What am I going to do with him? I just know that that is the beginning of my novel.
At what point did you decide that you wanted to also explore in that novel the concept of a happy marriage?
Well, I'd written a great deal about unhappiness. No one had ever complained. And I did get some trouble from some quarters describing a man who loved his work, who loved his wife, who got on well with his children, whose children were not drug addicts. And for a long time I thought, this is a great challenge. Maybe it's intellectual bad faith for people in the West to pretend that all of them are all unhappy all of the time. So maybe there is a challenge in representing happiness. I think there's only one novelist who's represented happiness really brilliantly, and that is Tolstoy in Anna Karenina. The early days of Levin's marriage to Kitty, I think, are one of the most exultant descriptions of marital love. I could come nowhere near this, but it did make me reflect, and I think about this a lot now. If you want to describe happiness in a moment, it's the poem that you turn to. Poetry takes us to the pinprick of the moment. If you want to describe ecstasy or sheer joy at a landscape or a lover, then it's poetry. The thing about the novel is it extends through time. Novels are long. They tend to catch people as they change. So the unhappy man becomes finally the happy one, or the happy man or the happy woman falls away into some problem and becomes unhappy. It is the nature of human experience. You cannot have a 50-year-old orgasm. It's not in the nature of things. And if it was boring, it would not be ecstasy. And you might think, when is this ever going to end? So that is why novels tend to deal with human conflict and development and change and falling away. So I had an attempt, because my novel was set in 24 hours, I could at least sustain some sense of domestic harmony, partly because I wanted my character to worry about the world. I wanted to set him free from the anxieties that fill so many novels about marriages and lovers and adultery and so on. There are other subject matters, and I wanted him to reflect on what was happening, and what was happening at that point was the nation was about to go to war. And we were still in the shadow of 9/11, and we were beginning to deal with a new sense of a world order, and I wanted him to fret and worry about that.
There is, in the end of this book, Saturday, a moment of startling dramatic impact, which is based upon a woman who is about to be raped, quelling her attacker by reciting a poem. This is a big narrative risk.
Yes, it was very risky. The point is, her attacker is suffering from a brain disease, a neurodegenerative disease, and what I tried to make clear was that his emotional state can tip very easily from one thing to another. I wasn't really suggesting that the best way to deal with an intruder into your house was to read poetry. I do not think this is usually a successful way of fending off aggressive types. But it was a risk. The poem especially lies right at the heart of a liberal, cultivated 19th century view of the world, On Dover Beach by Matthew Arnold. A poem, by the way, which is completely unfamiliar to my neurosurgeon, who says at one point, "Arnold who?" I mean, he has not touched. He's not a man touched by literature.
Your latest book to be published here on Chesil Beach takes, again, a very short time frame for the great majority of it, and certainly the central powerful scene, which is the portrayal of a truly excruciating and terrible wedding night. Can you, for people who are not so familiar with English coastal geography, explain what on Chesil Beach itself is and introduce...
Sure. Well, Chesil Beach is a rather extraordinary geological feature. It's a shingle beach. It runs for almost 18 miles. It's a narrow strip bounded on the one side by the English Channel, so we're talking about southern England, and inland by a saltwater lagoon. And this extraordinary finger of shingle, just maybe 200 meters wide, runs straight. I mean, sometimes you see it from the airplane. It's quite an exhilarating thing to see. It looks almost man-made. And when I saw it last, before writing this novel, I thought, what a wonderful place it would be to have some showdown, some emotional moment, some row, or something to unfold and be let loose from the heart, and then to have a character turn and walk away, a woman leaving a man and receding into the distance, and he'll never see her again and she will never see him. So it was the geology that shaped in a way the novel, and the geography of the shingle beach shaped a love story.
And it's set crucially in England, with all our zipped up, restrained awkwardness socially, but also in 1962, which comes at a particular time of kind of social and sexual history in Britain.
Yes, this is, as it were, this is 1962, but it's not yet what we call the 60s. This social revolution that seeped through all levels of society, it warmed up human relations in many ways. It wasn't only about rock and roll or marijuana or hippies or student protests. It actually was a great unbuttoning of society, and it took actually much longer than the 60s. It's extended in many ways. The feminist movement started then, the environmental movement, many things that we still regard as important and dynamic and unfolding happened just 3 or 4 years after my novel ends. So this was a time still when you might have thought yourself, if you were transported back into 1962, you might have thought you were also in 1935. You know, there were some rigidities that controlled social expression. And so, as people often mention about the English canon of literature, it's the things that are difficult to say or are unsayable, or the things that are left unsaid, that then become the force of a situation. The silences, the inability to articulate an emotion. And so here were two young people in their early 20s, well-educated, university graduates, married but sexual virgins, facing the moment finally in their hotel room. The wedding is all over. The guests have all gone. They've driven away down to the coast. And my novel, it's only a very short novel, a novella, just traces the events of the next 6 hours, with many flashbacks to And it seemed to be an obvious subject. I mean, I'm very fond of the novella. I think the 30,000, 40,000 word novel that could be read in 2 or 3 hours has a drama of its own, an appeal of its own. I love, you know, The Turn of the Screw of Henry James, or Death in Venice of Thomas Mann. There are many marvelous novellas, and often it seems to bring out the best in writers. I mean, Heart of Darkness, for example, a world classic, probably read more than Nostromo and Lord Jim.
Just go back for a second to this issue of the plot of On Chesil Beach. It's not uncommon for virgins to have terrible first sexual experiences, but one of the functions of setting this in 1962 is that you have to be married to have your first terrible experience, and therefore it's going to fuck up your life. Rather than just cause, you know, embarrassment at school the following day.
Exactly. So we're dealing with a time and a class of people. Yes, if you want to get the girl, first you've got to meet her parents, and then you've got to marry her. So I think many marriages began that way, I mean, out of sheer desire, and screw the consequences. So a lot is at stake, far more than is at stake in some casual sexual encounter now. I suppose for me, it's a return to the rather tightly controlled situations of the first couple of novels that I wrote that I described earlier. And maybe the novella does allow for a small stage. It is like chamber music. It is, it's a smaller space in which things can be explored with a kind of tenderness.
25 years on, if you have come, in some sense, to that book with a sort of full circle or a return, how do you perceive your powers now as regards how they were then? Because you can do more. You're now at the height of your capacity as a writer. Are you paring away? Are you more concentrated? Are you more in command of your language, of your emotional armory?
I talk to a lot of my writer friends about this. I think there's a consensus that it does not get easier. It should get easier to write a novel. You've been doing it for 30 or 40 or 50 years. You should know how to do it. But it always seems to me as if every novel is my first novel. And I falter. I'm very hesitant. I fumble. I wait. I suppose what I have developed over 25 years is more patience. My 25-year-old self would be furious with himself for not being able to progress something. I'd get stuck and I'd get furious. Now I learn the creative value of hesitation, of holding back just to see if it's the right thing. And I can wait. I'll wait weeks. I can just hang back. I'll do something else. I'll read, I'll hike, I'll cook, I'll do something else, rather than just write for the sake of it. I mean, in other words, I think hesitation is, for me, a crucial strategy in writing a novel.
How physical is your prose for you? Because I know that you like to oralize it. You like to speak it. You like to speak it while you're hiking.
I don't know if I speak it while I hike, but I certainly, that would drive any companion of mine nuts, I think. But I do like to read aloud to myself every paragraph as I write it. It's almost like tasting something. And maybe it's a way of being your own reader. It's one matter to transfer thoughts in your head onto the page. As soon as you speak them to yourself, you've already distanced yourself. It's coming back to you in the physical realm. You've become embodied, and matters like breathing or where your tongue is and how one word rubs against another suddenly matter. Also, the prose I like reading most and the prose that I try to write has a spring in it, In other words, between one sentence and another, the next sentence, there should be a logic. But that logic has to not be too pedestrian. There has to be a little gap of meaning which the reader can pull in. I think the master of the spring in the prose, and God rest his soul, is John Updike, who died last year. A real master of the implied meaning by the thing that is not said that falls between sentence A and sentence B. You hear that if you read it to yourself. You've got to get physical, as it were, with the prose.
Can I ask you one last question before opening this to the floor? You're currently publishing in Britain, in the next month or so, a novel that is set amongst, shall we say, the big issues of climate change. But again, I presume, is about individual identity and action.
Well, I mean, this novel had its beginning. I went to the Arctic 4 or 5 years ago with a group of scientists and artists. We were right up on the 80th parallel in Spitsbergen. It was minus 40. And we lived on a ship that was frozen into a fjord. And there, what struck me, and this was really the beginning of a novel, although I didn't realize it at the time, was a certain comedy. We would be talking, especially in the evening when the wine was flowing, about climate change, about politics, about what we must do, what governments must do, what the role of technology was, what individual responsibility was. And meanwhile, in the whole week that we were there, next door was a room where we kept all our heavy winter gear and helmets and goggles and thick gloves and liners for the gloves. And slowly, as the week went by, this changing room became more and more chaotic. It became so chaotic and beyond our control that some people weren't even allowed to get out of the boat because they couldn't find their stuff. And I thought, how wonderful, we're dreaming of how we're going to organize the whole earth, but we can't even organize the changing room right next to it. And suddenly I saw my way into the subject of climate change, which was through human nature rather than statistics or morals or virtue or blindness or whatever it was. And I had been thinking for 10 years, surely there's a novel in here, but I just couldn't think of it until I stepped into this detail, as it were. But even then, I mean, I went off and wrote Chesil Beach, and then I wrote an opera, and all the time I was thinking of that chaotic little room and how we couldn't organize it, and how that was a hint, that was a nudge for me to begin writing.
Ian McEwan, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have 15 minutes or so for questions. Could I take the first one, please, from right down here in the front? We've got headsets.
Yeah, wait a minute.
When you're asking in Spanish. Right down here. And then for ease of transport, the lady in the front row.
Me hago una pregunta sobre sus novelas y tal vez, entendiendo un poco el contenido, me parece que hay una forma un poco trágica e irónica de entender la vida y es esa una respuesta frente a una sociedad que día a día se derrumba más. Es una respuesta como escritor que se considera que contemporáneamente tenemos una responsabilidad impresionante. Es una respuesta frente a una sociedad que se desintegra. Gracias.
Well, I don't think society is disintegrating. I think it has many problems. But if I look, and by society, we look in all directions, we find societies. We in this theatre are a society bound by a love of literature. We might all have very different views of literature, but we are not currently killing each other. So I would say that we are a successful community, right here and now. And there are many societies, as it were, around us. Some of them are failing. Some in war-torn countries are disintegrating. But I don't buy into a complete pessimism about the human project. And again, if I were to confront my 25-year-old self, this is where we would part company. I think that in my case, and I think in the case of many writers, pessimism, total pessimism, is a wonderful luxury of youth. You can be recklessly pessimistic. I used to sometimes think of nuclear war, and a little exhilaration would come to my heart, and I'd think, bring it on. I will survive. And then I had children, and it all looked very different. As you get older, you have more of a sense of a wish for the human project to succeed. And so you start looking for those signs of hope. And, you know, the picture is mixed. But to give up on it, and I'm with Vargas Llosa on this entirely, to give up on this is a failure of the spirit. So many problems, but, you know, I think one must give a whole picture.
Okay, next question from the lady there.
Well, first I wanted to say that you should definitely write the sci-fi version of Atonement, because it'll be like a huge cult success. But what I really wanted to ask was that if you found some influence in James Joyce's Ulysses in writing Saturday, since they're both like going in a 24-hour period.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm certainly not the first novelist to set a novel within the discipline of 24 hours. And Joyce is really, I think, in the bloodstream of many writers. No one else before him, I think, had ever delineated consciousness, shown us the unfolding of consciousness through a day with such poetry and in his prose and such skill and observation. Nor had anyone quite given us the ordinariness of life without boring us. A man going to buy some kidneys to fry for his wife. A man sitting on the lavatory. I mean, it was a revolutionary book. But I still, despite what I say about Ulysses, I would still say that the finest pages that Joyce ever wrote are the last 10 or 12 pages of a long short story called The Dead. And they have had a huge impact on me. And I, for those readers for whom it matters, the last few lines of Saturday are a direct homage to the central character of The Dead, Gabriel, staring out the window of his hotel, seeing the snow falling, reflecting on the dead souls and the snow that is general all over Ireland, and falling on the mutinous Shannon waves and the grave of Michael Fury, and that he too will one day be part endless dead. One of the most magnificent, I think, stretches of prose in the English language. And they've also had a huge effect upon me. Could I just say something? The person who's asking me a question, could you just wave so I'm... Ah, great. So I can get a sense of...
Gracias, señor McEwan, por su presencia, por su... Gracias por su diálogo con nosotros esta tarde. Esta charla, esta conversación ha sido bastante emotiva para mí, que intento escribir, y ha habido varios momentos en los que me he sentido bastante identificado, específicamente cuando usted se refería a la imagen en la playa, porque aunque parezca inverosímil, esta mañana yo fui a la playa y me encontré una piedra que me gustó mucho, que tiene varias tonalidades de negro, y pues de una u otra forma no deja de ser expresivo para mí. La pregunta es, con esa comprensión que tiene usted de las imágenes, por su afición por la mente humana, ¿cómo discierne cuando hay en su mente una o más imágenes que usted podría llamar poéticas, pero cómo discierne usted para saber cuál puede ser más objeto de literatura? Gracias.
If I could, if I knew, maybe I wouldn't tell you. In case you ran off with my idea. I honestly don't know. You've just got to make a choice and trust yourself in just the way that you trust yourself to pick up that stone and not another one. And by trusting yourself, you must therefore take the great leap of faith that what moves you will move others. In other words, you reside your faith in a certain kind of universality of feeling. We might come from different cultures, we might have a whole range of different opinions and expectations, but I think we are bound by an emotional range of human nature that make us very similar. Without that similarity, there's no literature, and you've just got to trust it in the way that you preferred your stone with the dark streaks.
Gentleman down here.
Bien. En un momento maravilloso de Chesil Beach, la protagonista, en vez de escuchar una frase en su cerebro, escucha un motivo musical que le retumba y le retumba como si fuera un regaño. Y en una entrevista en el periódico El País, usted decía que la forma sonata era una de las formas, digamos, de las estructuras más perfectas que había. Quería saber que nos hablara un poquito de esa relación que usted ve entre formas musicales y formas literarias, y si uno puede decir que sus novelas cortas y sus novelas largas serían como música de cámara y música sinfónica.
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think we could spend a week on this. Well, what is the appeal of sonata form? First of all, you state a theme, then you expound on this theme. Then you state a second theme, you expound on this theme, the exposition. I can think of many literary equivalents, but in the case of Chesil Beach, I've tried to use music to separate the minds of the young man and the young woman. He loves rock and roll, or blues. She loves chamber music, she's a violinist, she's working on her rehearsals for a string quartet. They each try to persuade the other of their music, and they love each other, and they are determined to try and reach out for the other's music. When he goes to listen to her rehearsals, he's driven partly because he's heard too much about the cellist and he's jealous, but then he sees the cellist and realizes he has nothing to worry about. And he tries very hard, but comes to the conclusion that classical music is just a lot of mewling and scraping and tooting, and filled in its fast passages with prim agitation. He can't respond to it. It means nothing to him. For her part, when he tries to interest her in rock and roll, he plays her the records of Chuck Berry, and rather mistakenly plays her the song called Roll Over Beethoven. And she's frowning and trying to like it, and we know from the very words she uses, completely inappropriate words. She says it's very merry, it's very bouncy. And he knows with a disappointment in his heart that she is not seized with this music either. Later she confesses to him, in the spirit of honesty, that she cannot understand why music that is so simple, that has only three chords, that is written in common time, 4/4 time, why on earth it needs a drummer to beat out the time. And then he knows there is no chance. If she cannot understand why there's a drummer in Roll Over Beethoven, then she will never, never get it. So for me, again, it's about specifics, not using the pattern of the sonata, but using the music to help forge the characters and help give us a sense of their mutual incomprehension.
Question from the lady there.
Gracias, señor McEwan, por estar aquí. Quisiera saber cuál es su opinión sobre la adaptación cinematográfica que se ha hecho. Conozco dos que son Expiación y El placer del viajero. ¿Cuál es su opinión sobre esas novelas llevadas al cine?
Well, first of all, I should say that I was quite involved with the filming of Expiación. I was an executive producer. I didn't write the screenplay, but I saw nearly all the stages of draft, visited the set. I think it's a difficult novel to film, and maybe all novels are difficult to film, but I think that Joe Wright, the director, produced quite extraordinary version. I mean, when I say extraordinary, I'm not being evasive. I mean, I think it was very good. Especially the first half, which actually was the most difficult bit. The long psychological play that brings us to the point in which Bryony makes her misidentification in the violation of the young girl and accuses and makes a false accusation. I think the casting was superb. I loved the little girl, Saoirse, who played Bryony. But elsewhere, I thought Keira Knightley, everybody said Keira Knightley, that's the wrong casting at first, but then they saw a marvelous portrayal of an upper-class and rather brittle figure melting into love. I thought James McAvoy was superb, and many of the other smaller bits. And I thought that Joe Wright really had a genius for casting this film. I thought the cinematography was great. I loved the music. So I have to say that I was rather lucky. Usually, you know, when a novel is turned into a film, you lose so much. You lose all the interior, all the consciousness portrayed. Here I think, you know, given that this is a large film, a commercial film, I felt well served, and I'm quite grateful to Joe Wright for doing it so sensitively.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm really sorry. We've only got time for one more question, which is from the guy down here. I apologize to people upstairs, but I can't see you.
Good evening, Sir Ian. I just wanted you to expand a little on the last question. I was thinking that if there are...
It's because he's talking in English.
Oh, right.
If there's any... don't worry. How do you feel about the film adaptations from your novels, The Comfort of Strangers, Enduring Love, and is there any favorite among them, and have you ever considered writing directly to film?
I think one of my favorites, and I recommend it to you, is a film made on a very low budget of The Cement Garden, directed by Andrew Birkin, with Charlotte Gainsbourg in it, made for virtually nothing, using often students from film school on the set. I think over the whole run of them, Comfort of Strangers had a marvelous screenplay by Harold Pinter. I've been generally quite lucky, actually. Even the one that I probably had the most problems with was Enduring Love. Even there, I have to say, the director made the film that he wanted to make and made the film that he described to me. Much, you know, it parted company from the book in quite important ways, particularly in the casting of Daniel Craig, who was not, you know, a year later was James Bond. And it was very hard to feel that this character was under any threat by a stalker when Daniel Craig, with his muscles bulging through his shirt, was playing the character of Joe. But on the whole, I think I've been rather lucky that I've been involved with directors who are serious, you know, who actually really wanted to engage with the work. I have written screenplays. I once wrote a very commercial, or it ended up as a very commercial movie with Macaulay Culkin called The Good Son, a film from which I got sacked, but my name is still on it. I wrote a film about Mrs. Thatcher and history and the Falklands crisis called The Ploughman's Lunch. And I'm writing now the screenplay of Chesil Beach. I don't think I could bear anyone else to do it. That's why I'm doing it. And that's for Sam Mendes. And, well, we'll see what happens.
Ian McEwan, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed.